Resources. I'll be standing in for Bob Edmonds, and I'll be introducing the speaker today. I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Glenn Van Blaricum, who is it's actually part of my agency as well, part of the U.S. Geological Survey. He's the assistant leader of the Washington Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit. Yes. At the School of Aquatic and Fisheries Sciences. And Glenn is a longtime UW alum. He got his Bachelor of Science in Zoology and Oceanography in 1972, right across the street at the School of Aquatic and Fisheries Sciences. And then he got his PhD at UC San Diego at Scripps. And today he's going to be talking about the complexities of gooey duck aquaculture in Puget Sound.
All right, thanks, Chris. How's the volume? Can everyone hear me okay? Be sure to throw something, preferably something soft, if you can. Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and what I'd like to do today is talk about a project that we've been involved with actively since last spring, but we've been thinking about for several years. And it has to do with one of the storied local fauna, the gooey duck clam, and a controversy that has developed primarily in a very localized area in southern Puget Sound in our state that has to do with gooey duck aquaculture and some concerns about possible ecological effects and other types of effects that have sort of evolved into almost a clam war scenario. In fact, KUOW recently did a story on this situation, and the title of the story was Clam Wars. And I think it's still up on their webpage. They ran it several weeks ago. So if you're interested in their perspective on it, check that out and follow the link. So let's proceed here, and let's see. There we go. Okay, so let's start by saying just a little bit about the gooey duck clam itself, just to give you some background. The gooey duck is the largest known burrowing clam in the world. There are a few other species of clam that are larger, but they tend to be things like the giant clam of coral reefs and that sort of thing that sit on the surface and mainly attach to hard surfaces. As far as clams that live in the sand and the mud, this is as big as it gets. The siphon of a gooey duck clam may be up to a meter in length. If you've ever gone digging for gooey duck clams, you know that you can spend a good part of a low tide working on just one clam. It seems like you have to excavate about 10 cubic meters of sediment to get them out. They range from California to Alaska. They are filter feeders. They feed primarily on very small phytoplankton in the water column. They live for a really long time, up to 100 years, and maybe more. They're harvested commercially in Puget Sound and the inland waters of British Columbia. And the optimal harvest age for gooey ducks is sort of determined by market conditions and market demand, and it's about 5 to 7 year old animals that weigh on the order of a pound or two. Those are kind of the ideal for marketing. Traditionally in Washington, the gooey duck harvest has been the excavation of what we call wild clams. It's sort of hard to imagine a wild gooey duck, you know, sort of rampaging through the streets of the U District, tipping over trash cans and that sort of thing. But that's been the traditional approach, and much of the fishery, in fact, the entire commercial fishery, has been focused on individuals that are subtidal, that is, those that require diving. For harvest, a depth range of between about 20 and 70 feet. And the fishery started in the early 70s when the Navy, of all organizations, discovered during surveys of Puget Sound for reasons that only they know, suddenly became aware of all the gooey ducks that they were seeing, even in fairly deep water. And that led to communications with the Department of Fish and Wildlife and ultimately the development of a very lucrative fishery. Currently, the value, as you can see in the graphics here, is approaching $20 million. It continues to increase. At the present time, the wild harvest comprises about 85% of the total harvest. The gooey duck aquaculture component of the industry is relatively small, about 15% of the total harvest right now, but it's growing rapidly, and it's projected to reach as high as 40%, maybe even more than that, within the next decade. The primary markets for gooey duck products are Asia. Many of the clams that are harvested are actually air freighted live to Japan and China, where the primary markets are. I had the opportunity to visit the Tokyo fish market about 3 weeks ago, and I saw live Puget Sound gooey ducks for sale at the market in tanks of water with air stones and so on for about $40 per clam. Okay. So the demand is extraordinary. People are willing to pay a lot of money for these things. And as a consequence, it has become one of the more significant economic enterprises in our region in association with aquatic environments. Okay, with that as background, let's talk for just a minute about the aquaculture cycle as it currently occurs in Puget Sound. The aquaculture component of the industry occurs entirely on intertidal sand flats, primarily south of Tacoma. So it doesn't require any diving. All of the work is done when the tide is out. And as I have found out recently, during the wintertime, that means getting up in the middle of the night to work on them. It's delightful. And if anybody wants to volunteer to spend a night on the sand flats, please let me know, because we don't exactly have people queuing up at the door to do that sort of thing. It's actually a lot of fun. It's great fun. Sort of like painting fences and that sort of thing. So typically, the gooey ducks are hatched in a hatchery, and the young clams are outplanted when they're just a few months old. That occurs, obviously, at the beginning of the cycle. Then for about a year, the animals are contained within predator exclusion structures, which I'll show you in just a moment, because they are vulnerable as young animals to predation from crabs and shorebirds and a few other things. But those structures are typically removed after about a year or so, when the clams become large enough and deeply enough buried in the sediment that they don't require the continuing protection from predators. So most of the rest of the cycle is a simple process of allowing the animals to get large enough so that they're marketable. And somewhere between 5 and 7 years after the initial outplanting, they're harvested and sent off to market. And as I mentioned earlier, the timing of the harvest, the size and the age of the animals at harvest, is largely determined by market conditions rather than by biological issues. So let's go through that again in a little more detail with the support of photographs here. So this is the initial planting process. These are young gooey ducks. You can see that they're, you know, sort of the size of a quarter, little tiny guys, fresh out of the hatchery. The process involves what's referred to as tube stomping, as you can see here. These large fields of PVC tubes are created in the intertidal zone. These are, well, you can see the size of the guy's foot here. They're on the order of 6 to 8 inches in diameter. Different growers use different sizes. They all have their own sort of secret formula for figuring out the optimal size and number and distance between and that sort of thing. But the clams are actually planted in the sediment within the tube. And then the tubes are covered either with an individual piece of netting that's secured over the tube with a heavy-duty rubber band, or with a large field of netting that covers all the tubes. And that's what we see here. So here are the tubes, and this obviously has been out for a while. You can see that there's netting with a lot of stuff growing on it, and then sort of a progressively larger scale photograph of the same area. You can see that the field of tubes and the netting that protect them from the predators can be quite large. So as I mentioned, typically these predator exclusion structures are left in place for about a year, and then they're removed, and then from that time forward, the clams are simply allowed to grow. Harvest is done, again, at low tide, and it involves the use of a high-velocity water hose. This is actually a stiff piece of pipe that's attached to the end of the hose. The hose runs out to a little raft that's just offshore. It has a water pump that pumps water continuously. And the water jet is used to liquefy the sediment around the gooey ducks. The harvesters go out first and mark the position of all the gooey duck siphons with little wooden sticks, sort of like little skewers that you'd use for shish kebab and that sort of thing. And then they progressively work their way through the clam bed, basically using the water jet to liquefy the sediment so that they can easily reach down and pull the clams out. It's actually pretty efficient. And people that are experienced at it can really crank these things out in a hurry. It beats the heck out of digging them with a shovel, and I can vouch for that based on personal experience. And then they're packed up. They put rubber bands around the shells to protect the animals, and then off they go to the airport, basically, for a quick shipment to an Asian market. Okay, so that's kind of the basic background, and now I wanted to talk a little bit about the political issues that have pushed this enterprise into the spotlight, into the regulatory spotlight within the state of Washington. And the first issue is pretty easy to grasp, and really all you need to know is contained in this photograph right here. Here are expensive waterfront homes in southern Puget Sound, and when the tide goes out, this is what they see, these fields of tubes. Okay, and they don't last, they're not there permanently, as I said. They're there for on the order of a year or so at any particular location. But people don't like them. It's as simple as that. And they want them to go away. And associated with this activity, there have been problems with tubes eroding out of the sediment during storms and sort of rolling up on the beach, bits of netting becoming detached and getting tangled up in boat propellers and that sort of thing. But I think that really the key issue is simply that these folks don't like looking at this activity. And they feel, in a sense, that even though this is not their property, that their property, broadly defined, is being violated by the presence of this kind of activity. It's not what they bought into when they bought their dream home for retirement. It's looking at this sort of activity. So the same people that have raised this issue of unsightliness have also pushed the second issue, which is the one that we're more directly involved with, which is the argument that this type of activity may actually be ecologically damaging to these intertidal ecosystems in southern Puget Sound. And these are sort of typical of the images that show up on the websites of the organizations that are opposed to the culture activity. And these are not unrepresentative photographs. This is very typical of the type of activity, especially that it occurs around the time of harvest. And as you can see, the harvest does create recognizable disturbances in the intertidal zone that raise questions about ecological impacts. And this is just a camera lens cap here, just for scale. It's about 6 centimeters in diameter. Okay, in approaching this problem, we've recognized that we need to put it into a conceptual ecological context to try to evaluate disturbances associated with gooey duck aquaculture in the context of disturbance ecology in general. This is a topic that I've always been particularly interested in, and it's always been my view that natural disturbance is every bit as important in understanding community structure as things like predation and competition and habitat selection and a broad range of other issues. Often we think of disturbance as sort of an extraneous matter, but the reality is that it's not, that it's a standard part of the ecology of most ecosystems, and I'll probably repeat that several times, so I'll apologize now for doing that. And we need to think of it as such, and not necessarily to think of disturbance as something that's extraneous and bad, but rather something that is a typical part of the system, and I'll elaborate on that view. This is a sort of a standard definition of disturbance published in one of the definitive publications on disturbance ecology back in the 80s. You can read it there, and I've got lots of spectacular pictures just to illustrate the point that disturbances are normal and natural, and they occur in most ecosystems. We tend to be familiar with the large-scale disturbance events that attract the attention of the news media, tsunamis, forest fires, hurricanes, I think this is Katrina, scary looking thing, Mount St. Helens, and of course the ultimate form of disturbance is, on an evolutionary scale, is impact with extraplanetary bodies that do terrible things to our planet. But in fact, small-scale disturbances are also common. They're pervasively common in natural ecosystems. And these are just a few examples. Here we have a tree that's been blown over in a windstorm and has created what we call a tip-up, a root mass that's been extracted from the ground as the tree has fallen, creating a patch of ground, which is just off the picture, that is disturbed by a natural process. A walrus feeding on clams on the bottom in the Bering Sea, tearing at the bottom in order to get to a clam that's buried in the mud so that it can feed. This is a dugong in the off the coast of Australia foraging in a seagrass bed, disturbing the bottom during the process of pulling up both the leaves of the seagrass and also the roots or rhizomes, if you will, in order to forage. Prairie dogs that at least once were fairly common in parts of North America that often create mounds that involve disturbance of the soil and alteration of local plant communities as part of their social system. And then finally, this side-stand sonar, which is the bottom of the Bering Sea, in an area where gray whales have been foraging on amphipods, small crustaceans that live on the bottom, creating these pits in the bottom that are about a meter across and about 3 or 4 meters in length. And as you can see, they can occur at high density and create, by virtue of aggregation of a large number of small disturbances, create effectively a large-scale disturbance in the system. All of these being entirely natural processes. And in one way or another, bearing some linkage to the kind of disturbance that we're talking about with geoduck duck aquaculture. Obviously, there are also a broad range of anthropogenic disturbances that we have to deal with. And I'll buy a beer to the first person that can tell me what event is represented by this photograph. Come back to it. It's one of the goofiest things that ever happened in this part of the world. So we can have large-scale disturbances such as this thing, which is obviously an explosion, and smaller-scale events such as the harvest of geoducks, subtidally, and many other events. Some of them as simple as running a lawnmower that disturb the natural ecosystems of our area and create important ecological responses. So these are in attacking this problem and trying to figure out what we're dealing with in terms of geoduck aquaculture, these are sort of my operating premises. The first is, you've already heard, that natural disturbances are common. They're pervasively common aspects of the ecology of natural ecosystems. And there are very few exceptions to that, in my view. Secondly, that a key way of evaluating the potential impact and the potential damage of a human activity is to try to understand how the disturbances associated with that activity, try to understand how those resemble natural disturbance processes that may also be happening in the same community. Okay? Try to understand the difference. And I've tried to represent that graphically. I'll show you that in just a moment. But when we compare disturbances from anthropogenic and natural sources, there's some sort of standard metrics that we think about. And we know, based on a lot of studies and a lot of habitats, that these are key metrics in understanding how disturbances influence natural ecosystems. For example, we need to know how often a particular type of disturbance occurs, and how long does the disturbance act? Is it something like a fire that might go on for a few weeks? Is it a point event like an avalanche or a landslide that only proceeds for a matter of a few seconds to a few tens of seconds? We want to know how intensive the disturbance is. How hot is the fire? How intense and severe is the avalanche? How much earth is actually, earth or snow or whatever the case is, actually moving downslope? What is the physical size of the disturbance? Is it a big fire or a small one? A big landslide or a small one? What are the chemical and physical attributes of the disturbance? Is it a fire, which causes certain types of responses in the ecosystem, as opposed to an avalanche, which creates a very different sort of disturbance at the physical and chemical level? And finally, and this is the part that I'm actually the most interested in, what are the patterns of recovery of the ecosystem in question to each particular type of disturbance? How long does it take for that system to come back to where it was before the disturbance occurs? If an avalanche occurs and rips out a bunch of trees, how long does it take before the trees naturally recede the avalanche slope and grow back to the size distribution that was present before the avalanche occurred? That sort of thing. Okay. So these are the metrics that we use when we compare one kind of disturbance with another. And here now is just a reiteration of my argument that if the similarity between the effects of an anthropogenic disturbance and a natural disturbance is high, indicated by the sort of metaphorically by the overlap of these circles, then it's my argument that the chances of that anthropogenic disturbance causing serious ecological damage are relatively low. Okay? Because we argue that it's basically the same kind of disturbance, and it's something to which the populations in that community are likely accommodated on both ecological and evolutionary timescales. If, however, the similarity between the effects of the anthropogenic disturbance and the natural disturbance are low, then the risk of damage occurring becomes greater. Now, how much greater, you can't generalize without knowing more about the details of the system at hand. But at least in relative terms, if an anthropogenic disturbance is radically different from anything that ever happens in nature, and is one to which the organisms simply have no ecological or evolutionary history of exposure, then at least the risk of serious damage, of displacing populations or species, modifying the habitat in a way from which the species can't recover, that sort of thing, that risk becomes higher. It's not to say it's going to be serious damage in every case, but it is to say that the risk of such damage becomes higher. Okay, so with that as a conceptual background, then I want to come back to the Gooey Duck issue. We were fortunate enough to receive funding from the Washington Sea Grant Program last spring to work on this problem, to try to understand how disturbances associated with Gooey Duck aquaculture activity are actually influencing the ecosystem and how we might compare those disturbance effects coming from the industry with natural disturbances in the system. And we focus on three categories of disturbance and on three categories of response variables. Okay? So we're interested, first of all, in disturbances that happen when the tube stomping occurs that I mentioned earlier. You've got all these people out there stomping around, literally, in the intertidal, creating footfall type disturbances, and also emplacing structures, dragging sacks of equipment around, that sort of thing. It's certainly not unreasonable to assume that that might be disturbing the ecosystem at hand. There's a similar set of disturbances that may occur when those structures are removed somewhere in the first or second year of the culture cycle. So the removal of structure can also be associated with disturbance. Now, in general, in watching that process, we don't have the perception that it's a major upheaval for the ecosystem. But we can't rule that out until we get some data. We get some information from response variables so that we can actually test that, hopefully with some level of objectivity. The third category is the most obvious, and that is the disturbance that is associated with harvest. Okay, and we think that could be a big deal. All right. The sediment is being liquefied. The pore water, the water that occurs in the interstices between the individual sediment particles, is being flushed out, and it sort of runs off along the top of the sediment into the adjacent Puget Sound. So the chemistry of the sediment is probably being modified. There are a lot of nutrients and deposits of detritus and other types of organic matter in the sediments that could be important to the ecology of the system. That may be getting flushed out by virtue of this disturbance. And then there's sort of the obvious physical disturbance as well of just moving the sand around and all that sort of thing. So these are the three categories of disturbance we're looking at, and this is what we're measuring as a way of telling us how the ecosystem is responding. The first is, and most importantly right now, in the early stages of the project, is to look at the infauna. These are the populations of small organisms that actually live in the sand, okay, and emphasis on the small. These are tend to be things that you can only see under a microscope. Typically, we take core samples screen the core samples through a series of sieves, and then look at the retained material under a microscope. And we get things like polychaete worms and small amphipod crustaceans, small clams, juvenile sand dollars, things like that that tend to dominate the infaunal community. The second thing that we're looking at is populations of mobile invertebrates that occupy these habitats. And here we're mainly talking about crabs. There are a lot of crabs in southern Puget Sound. There are several species that are well represented. And they do tend to respond to structures. So we're interested in the extent to which they might either be attracted to structures or might be damaged by the presence of structures in some way. And I'll develop that idea in just a moment. But in any case, looking at how the distribution and numbers of crabs and other mobile invertebrates on the intertidal might be influenced by the structures, and then later on by disturbances associated with the harvest. And then we have this third category, which focuses on the potential for this kind of activity to influence salmon biology. I took this one on under protest because salmon are not my principal research interest, but there is so much political concern about any form of disturbance that might influence habitat, in this case particularly for juvenile salmon, that we will be looking at that. We have not actually started that phase of the project yet, so I won't say too much about it today. But grudgingly, we're going to have to look at it. So we have that in our list. Okay, what I want to do now is focus in on these specific categories of disturbance and try to give you a little bit better idea of how things might be working. And this is based largely on a variety of studies of disturbance and placement of structure and that sort of thing that have been done in other locations and other contexts. So we're drawing ideas from the existing literature on disturbances in intertidal sand flats, subtidal sands, and that sort of thing, in order to generate hypotheses about what might actually be happening in this situation. So let's focus first on the effects of structural placement. I've got several slides here on this topic. The first thing that we think of when we think of placing structures in an intertidal marine habitat is all the stuff that starts growing on the structure. Okay, that immediately creates changes to the local habitat, and it does so in several ways. First of all, the organisms that live on the tubes, for example, algae, barnacles, mussels, tube worms, broad range of other species, generate particles, inorganic particles. For example, barnacles die and then their shells decompose and the bits of shell fall down to the sediment. So we can get an alteration of the pattern of grain size distribution in the sediment as a simple consequence of structures nearby that are producing these biogenic particles, if you will. It turns out that the distribution of grain size in sediments is a very important determinant of a number of ecological functions associated with sedimentary communities, including things like distribution and abundance of resident species. So changes in grain size are often an important issue, and it's something that needs to be monitored. And this is the sort of thing that we anticipate might be happening with the placement of structures. There are also a series of organic influences that can be anticipated just as these structures are attracting organisms that produce bits and pieces of inorganic material that alter sediment grain size. They're also producing organic matter. The algae falls off. The barnacles defecate. The feces fall to the sediment, they're colonized by bacteria, so one can easily imagine a long chain of biochemical interactions that alter the chemistry of the sediment, alter properties such as organic carbon availability, pH, salinity, you name it, a broad range of potential effects. They also affect the availability of oxygen in the sediment, which turns out to be a really important issue. Decaying matter, as you're probably aware, consumes oxygen. And if the supply of decaying matter to a marine sediment occurs at a high enough rate, the oxygen in the sediment will be consumed. It will become anoxic. And if you've ever been on a really great gooey mud flat and turned the mud over with a shovel, you know exactly what I'm talking about, because it often appears black in color, smells like rotten eggs, and that's because sulfide is being produced in the sediment because there's no oxygen left. That's a result of organic material coming in faster than the oxygen supply can cope with.
And that's what I won't go into this redox discontinuity here. We don't really have time for that, but that's a reflection of oxygen consumption in the sediment. Okay. So the higher the organic supply, the worse off things are in the sediment if oxygen supply is inadequate.
Okay, there's a physical effect that can also come with structures, and the photograph is a bit unclear, but this is actually a glass cylinder that has been set into a bed of sand, and this is in a laboratory setting. And then the water has been set in motion with a system of pumps, simply to illustrate that anytime you place structures on a sedimentary habitat where there is water motion above that habitat, you tend to get scouring effects, okay? And this can cause transport of sediment away from the bases of the structure, and that's what's happened here. You might get some downstream deposition of the material that's being scoured away from the structure base. And in the process of that transport and scouring, you can get alterations in sediment grade size distribution and also changes in the chemistry of the sediment because, the pore water and the various chemical attributes of the water within the sediment are being altered by this process. So this is another type of physical effect. And, of course, the larger the structure and the stronger the current, the more serious this sort of scouring situation can develop. And as you can also imagine, these structures can also act as baffles that cause currents to slow down. And when they slow down, they drop their sediment load, and you can actually get accumulations of sediment depending on the details of the hydrodynamics. And then finally is a really interesting effect, which is something that I've worked on in the past called the halo effect. And this involves attraction of predators to a structure. And here again, the crabs would be a good example because they like to hang out around stuff that's sitting on the sediment. I used to do some work in California in a subtidal sandy habitat that was level sand at about 60 feet depth, and it was just amazing to me. We were 5 miles away from the nearest rocky reef. All you had to do is stick a piece of rebar in the sand, and if you came back the next day, there would either be a crab or a fish sitting next to it. You know, it's like, wow, what about that? So organisms in the ocean are routinely attracted to structures, and crabs are a particularly good example of that. What happens is that they're using the structure, which in this case is the culture plot, as habitat. They're using it as a place to hide during the day, perhaps as a place to forage. But in addition to that, they're traveling outward from the structure and foraging on organisms on the adjacent habitat. They're actually becoming what we call central place foragers, which is sort of like what you see with nesting birds, where they're anchored in a central location and then moving outward from that location to forage. And the result of that is that certain prey species might be depleted in the area close to the structure by virtue of that predatory behavior. So you get this halo, as it were, of area around the structure where the species composition and abundance is different as a direct result of predators attracted to the structures. Okay, so now let's look at some hypotheses relating to the harvest disturbance. As I mentioned, the harvest involves liquefaction of the sediments using high-velocity water jets and the removal of clams that are dislodged. This disturbance may be repeated as many as 3 or 4 times over the span of a week because as the harvesters move through a particular bed of clams, some of the clams retract and are overlooked the first time through, so they often need to make several passes in order to get all the clams that they want for market. So it's a disturbance that is both instantaneous but also continuous in the sense that they keep coming back over the span. Sometimes this may continue over subsequent tide series such that it can go on for perhaps as much as several months before they're finished. Okay, so what are the likely effects of this process? Well, the first sort of obvious ones are that there are going to be animals that are not targeted by the harvest that are going to be injured, dislodged, relocated by virtue of just the physical activity of the harvest, okay? Some of these animals will die as a result of their injuries directly. The bodies will be irrevocably injured by the act of extraction of the clams. What also tends to happen is as the harvesters move on, there tend to be a number of scavengers that come in very quickly. Gulls and shorebirds are good examples, but as the tide comes in, the fish and the crabs and other things will finish off what the shorebirds and the gulls weren't able to get to. So anything that is disturbed and injured and is made more available to a scavenger is very likely to be consumed as the harvesters move on. Certainly within a day or two after the event, and often much sooner than that. The other thing that happens and is really important is that there is often a successional sequence, a predictable successional sequence that follows a disturbance, and that's what I've tried to represent here. This is just a hypothetical cartoon, obviously, of the process, but what I've tried to represent is relative abundance of four different species, A through D, and number of days since disturbance, and this is actually based on a study of response to disturbance that I did way too many years ago, but is in fact relevant to this situation. So we have species that come in very quickly after the disturbance happens. They may be coming in because species that normally live there and maybe feed on these early colonists or something like that have now been displaced. Okay, so there's room. There's empty space that's available. And there are species typically that jump on that stay around for a very short time period, and then they move on. And then we have a succession of later species that may be a little more abundant, maybe stay a little bit longer, and as you can see, all of these have long tails, that may be a few individuals around in the long term. But the real pulse tends to drop off fairly quickly. A third wave represented by C here, and then finally sort of a redwood tree analog, if you will, a species or a group of species that tend to be the long-term residents that take a while to recover from the disturbance, but once they become established, tend to stay around for the long term in fairly high abundance until another disturbance happens, and then we go through the process again. And you can imagine that if these localized disturbances are happening frequently over a large area at different times, then you've got this mosaic, this really interesting mosaic of successional states where for any particular location, where you are in the sequence in terms of species abundance depends directly on how long it has been since that site was disturbed. Okay? If different areas within a plot that have different disturbance histories, they're going to have different patterns of abundance of the resident infauna or whatever you might be looking at, simply as a result of the elapsed time since the disturbance occurred. This is a pattern that we need to understand if we're going to understand how the disturbance process works. So, with all that as background, this is what we're actually doing. And I know you're desperately hoping I'm going to tell you the punchline that either the Gooey Duck aquaculture is doing terrible damage, or it's totally innocuous and everything is fine. And I will tell you right now that since we just started, we don't know the answer yet. So you're going to have to, keep your eye on the website and read our papers and that sort of thing as the years go down. But so this is where we are now. We have just gotten to the point where we have most of our study sites up and running, and we've worked out a protocol for sampling. And whoops!
What have I done here? How about restart later? Would that be good or bad? It looks like I made the right guess.
So what we've done is we've identified several sites in southern Puget Sound that are scheduled for harvest within the next year, and several other sites that are scheduled for outplanting of new gooey ducks within the next year or so. Keep in mind that because the culture cycle runs for on the order of 5 to 7 years, it's not possible for us to simply start at the beginning of a culture cycle at a particular site and then sample our way through that 5 to 7 year period. Any of you in the room that have ever written grant proposals know how difficult it is to get money for anything beyond about a 3-year time window. So what we've done instead is what we refer to as a space for time substitution. We're basically selecting different plots that are in different phases of the culture cycle and sort of sampling them all at the same time so that we could hopefully get a jump start on the general pattern. This is not as good as in a design sense as tracking a single site from start to end, and having several of those sites working. But it's the best we can do given this, the realities and the constraints of our funding. So at each site that is scheduled for harvest, we have set up the following. So this is the shoreline, this wavy line here, and this is the ocean down here, or the sound, I guess. And this is the cliff and the spruce trees and so on up here. And at each site that is scheduled for harvest, we have set up a plot that we refer to as the treatment plot. This is a plot that's within the bed of clams that has that is under culture, that is scheduled for harvest. We refer to that as the treatment. And then we have an adjacent plot that we refer to as the control. Now, if you understand the details of experimental design, you know that we're using the word control very loosely here. Okay, this is definitely not an ideal laboratory type experimental design. It's simply not possible to implement that sort of design in the real world. So there are always problems when you use adjacent areas for controls, because there may be subtle differences between treatment and control plots that we don't understand that may mislead us in terms of our conclusions. So we have to be cautious about that. But this is the general idea. Within the treatment plots, we are taking 10 randomly placed core samples during each sampling event. We're also taking 10 larger samples where we're actually digging larger volumes of sediment out and screening it through a very large screen. The idea here is to take larger samples so that we can track the abundance of larger, less abundant organisms, so that may nevertheless be important. The core samples, of course, are the source that we use to get our infaunal data. We're doing the same sampling plan in the control plots as we are in the treatment plot. In addition, on the treatment plots, we're sampling, taking a series of samples with increasing distance away from the culture plot. And the idea here is to try to understand how far away from a plot harvest disturbance is actually influencing the organisms that live there. So even though, you know, I may be a tube worm living here, and the edge of the harvest plot may be the back wall of this room, there could still be effects on me as a resident by virtue of sediment that's stirred up into the water column that might be washed down my way by the tide, might cover me up and make it difficult for me to feed, that sort of thing. So we have to evaluate that possibility as well, and that's why we're sampling with increasing distance away from the culture plots. Now, obviously, we're not doing this at the control plots because there's no harvest scheduled for the control plots. But otherwise, the sampling scheme within the treatment and control plots is the same. And we're using the same basic approach in sites that are scheduled for outplanting in the near future. In other words, we're working with the companies that are involved to identify the locations where planting is going to be done, and then initiating this sort of a sampling routine before the disturbance actually occurs, through the period of the disturbance, and then for hopefully a period of at least a year after the disturbance, so we can get at not only the spatial extent of this disturbance, but also how long it takes for the organisms that live there to sort of get back to the configuration that they were in before the disturbance occurred, so that we can address some of those conceptual issues that I mentioned earlier. Right now we have 5 active sites. We have another one in the works in southern Puget Sound. So we have, I'm going to test my memory here, we have 3 sites 1, 2, and 3, that are currently scheduled for harvest within the next year, okay? Probably at different times within the next year. But in any case, in all 3 of these sites, and this is southern Puget Sound, this is Olympia down here, Shelton over here, which I point out is where I was born. Tacoma is off the chart, kind of up this way. This is McNeil Island and Anderson Island. We mainly are focusing in the Southern Sound for political reasons, because that's where the controversy is most heated at this time. So the folks at Sea Grant actually asked us to focus on the Southern Sound first. Sites 4 and 5 are sites that are scheduled for outplanting, again, within the next year. And we are hoping to add a third outplanting site in southern Puget Sound. We're working with the state right now to get that set up. So that's the plan, that's the concept, and we hope that within a year we can have some answers as to what's going on. I will tell you this, I've been surprised in looking at the data at the low diversity and abundance of infaunal organisms within this system. And I have a hunch, based on what I've seen so far, that we're going to see that the effects of gooey duck aquaculture on the resident communities are actually relatively minimal. But at this point, that's a hunch. And of course, we need to let the data speak for themselves. So once we have the numbers all crunched and collected and organized and analyzed, then we'll take a hard look and we'll let you know. We've got a few minutes left, and I'd be happy to answer any questions till the bell rings. Yes? Oh, yeah, sorry. So these are just local names that we've given them. Just repeat the question.
Yeah.
You just asked me to name off the sites, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so sites 1, 2, and 3 are sites that are currently scheduled for harvest. This is, there's a big piece of property adjacent to this site that's owned by the Foss family. It's also next to Joima State Park, so that we call it the Foss-Joima site. This is the Mankey site on the eastern edge of Hartstein Island, which is also a scheduled harvest site. And then the Chelsea Wang site in southern Puget Sound in Elb Inlet that is also scheduled for harvest. Chelsea is the name of the company that owns the plot, and Wang is the name of the adjacent landowner. And then Rogers and Fisher are the two sites scheduled for outplanting in the near future. And again, Rogers and Fisher are the names of the adjacent landowners. We do have to obtain the cooperation of the landowners in order to get access to our sites. And everyone that we've worked with, by the way, has been very cooperative. Yes?
Is there anyone looking at the density lifespan of the gooey ducks themselves, like, so their density is having an effect on them?
Yes, the question is anyone looking at the density of the gooey ducks and whether or not the issue of density is having an effect on the influenza? And that's actually built into our contrast between control and treatment. So we're actually getting that as a result of that part of our effort. The natural density of gooey ducks in the sound in the intertidal zone is quite variable. And while the cultured plots have a very high density, it's actually within the natural range for gooey ducks. So it's, in that sense, it's sort of natural. It's definitely at the high end. And it's a kick to walk through in these culture plots because, you know, gooey ducks tend to, they're the species that tend to squirt water up when you're walking around. And it's just a total boot if you stop and look around. And believe me, trying to take a picture of that, you know, as soon as you put your camera down, you're squirting like crazy, pick it up, and it'll stop. Yes? I'm sorry, try again.
Are there any beneficial effects?
Okay, the question is, are there any beneficial effects? There could be. And it depends a little bit on your own values, but particularly with regard to the structure fields. The presence of those tubes and the netting and so on attracts a number of species that would probably not be there otherwise. So you could make the argument that it actually enhances the local biodiversity of the system. Now, they wouldn't be there if it wasn't for the gooey duck aquaculture. So, you could also argue that that's kind of a bogus argument. But some people make that case that, okay, we're actually enhancing biodiversity. And in fact, some of the people that are unhappy with the gooey duck aquaculture activity in general don't want us to take the tubes out, us meaning the industry, because they say, well, but you're reducing the biodiversity. And it's like, well, make up your minds, folks. You know, which way do you want it? So there is that argument. But again, we can address it much more effectively once we have our data in hand. Yes?
Are they planted in the same sites, or is it just kind of one time?
Yeah, good question. There is, typically, the question is, do they replant in the same sites? And typically the answer is yes. Usually within a few months after harvest. And that's actually an issue for us in terms of our design, because we'd like to be able to track the recovery process. But if they're coming right back in and planting a new set of ducks, then that sort of messes that up. We are committed to, dealing with the industry as it is, warts and all. But that's an issue. And there are a few places where they're not doing that. So what we're hoping is that we could take advantage of that to look at that longer-term perspective. But yeah, in general, they're right back in there. I think
thank you so much.